Today we are very happy to welcome our colleague and freshly PhD Ali Shadari. He's a Manikuli Fellowship at IMI, and this term we decided to go for a thematic seminar. And so the topic of the seminar this term should be on migration and social protection. So you can see the program on the door. And today we can begin with a talk of Ali, because he's working on social protection, migration from Pakistani perspective in different places in the world. And next week we should have our usual IMI seminar, so between 1 and 2 on Wednesday. And on Thursday we have Jack Port, which is a researcher from New Zealand who should come in Oxford. So on Thursday at the same time, so between 1 and 2, we have an additional seminar, and would like you to participate for that. So you have approximately half an hour, 40 minutes. Great. And then we can go for a discussion after. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. Thanks for this nice introduction, Yasser. I guess before I start, I'll qualify that the project, what I'm going to talk about today, is about it's coming from a larger project, which was not about social protection. It's transnational social protection. It was about migrant organizations in these three cities. But today's talk, as we go through it at the end, I'll focus on what my findings say about social protection, transnational social protection in particular, with a specific focus on social service organizations and migrants forming. So that's just to put that out there before we get into it. So the past 20 years has witnessed what scholars refer to as the transnational turn in migration settings. And through a assortment of theoretical developments in the literature and empirical studies, what has been one of the overarching themes in this has been the declining significance of the nation state, the declining significance of national borders, national boundaries, and then increasingly economic, political, cultural, social phenomena are transversing borders. So this has been a recurring theme in migration studies over the last 20 years. At the same time, though, we see terrorism and securitization resulting in a global reorganization of state control. And in this paper, I argue that what we've seen unfolding over the last 10 years is this new reorganization of global state control, which uses symbolic imagery of terrorism and national security to reinstitute borders, reinstitute these types of controls. So we have this juxtaposition happening in the contemporary moment. In this work, I refer to the war on terror as a coercive global regulatory regime. And what that entails is an assortment of things that happen simultaneously, including state policies that have to do with counterterrorism, counterterrorism-inspired practices done at the local level, the global level, internationally, surveillance and profiling of groups deemed to be threats, biased media representations, and of course, normative beliefs that go along with all of this kind of war on terror rhetoric that we've had for the last 15 or so years. Now, in respect to the organizations that I'm studying, there's also a specific regulatory apparatus that is tied to this overall regime. And this begins in 2002, shortly after the September 11 attacks. Then President George W. Bush signs an executive order which instructs the U.S. Department of Treasury to start constructing global lists of all organizations that may be involved in the financing of terrorism abroad and in a variety of countries. And through this process, the U.S. Department of Treasury enlists the help of governments all over the world to cooperate with the Treasury Department in trying to figure out where is the terrorist financing flowing and how is it traversing borders. In 2005, the Treasury Department releases a compliance toolkit which gives best practices of how organizations should behave. And what's written in this compliance is, if you're not following these steps, you're going to be subject to investigation. You're not going to be in compliance with the regulations. In the UK, the Charity Commission follows suit and creates the same type of apparatus here in the UK, and Canada also creates the same thing. These are the three countries that are the comparers of Canada, the US, and the UK. So what we've seen happen since the creation of this has been high-profile investigations of the largest, most well-funded, most well-known Muslim charities and organizations in the US, in the UK, and in Canada. And this list up here, these are really the largest organizations. These are the organizations that most Muslim people trust. So if they want to give a donation, these are the organizations that they usually tend to feel, these are legitimate, I can give the organization. But you'll see all these organizations have been subjected to these high profile investigations, which has created a lot of insecurity around people's notion that should they donate or should they not. So this is just to give a little bit of the background of the study of what's happening. So I want to also take a moment to situate this, what I'm going to talk to you about, in the existing literature. So over the past 15 years, there's been what I call in this work an organizational turn in migration studies. And it's not that migration scholars didn't talk about organizations before, they did, but it seems like in the last 15 years, we've discovered, like, oh wow, organizations actually do things, and they actually help in the migration process. So we have a variety of studies that have emerged in the last 15 years, which document how organizations help facilitate immigrant settlement and incorporation in receiving studies. We also have a growing literature that talks about how organizations help facilitate migrant transnational engagement and development in origin countries. But one thing that's missing in most of this literature that's emerged is researchers have yet to examine how migrant social service organizations experience and operate within the global regulatory regime. So this whole thing I just outlined, much of the literature hasn't been looked at this. Like, how do migrant organizations, whether they're doing incorporation, social service delivery, development, how do they operate in this environment of the war on terror? Now, one of the reasons why there hasn't been much of an interest or a look at how organizations operate in this environment is what I refer to in this paper as a general detachment of migration studies from the field of organization studies. And this is something that we see happening a lot in different areas of migration studies, where because of the interdisciplinary nature of migration studies as a whole, you can sometimes see that certain aspects of certain disciplines are kind of glossed over. So organization studies is a mainstream part of sociology, but in general, most people that have studied immigrant organizations haven't really used that literature to frame studies of organizations. So in particular, there's a lack of emphasis on structure, behaviors, and strategies of organizations themselves. And related to that, a lack of an understanding of how organizations operate in different types of environments. And I highlight here the very influential piece that was written in 1983 on institutional isomorphism and imagery of how, which as I go through this, you'll see like how this actually helps understand what's happening to these micro-organizations. Another area within organization studies which is also relevant for this study is research that's been emerging over the last 10 years on stigmatized organizations. So here, organization scholars have looked at how different types of organizations deal with stigma. So they've taken this Goffman idea of individual stigma and applied it to firms. So some of these studies emerged in the early 2000s, looking at the firm Enron, after its huge scandal, something like that, what do? So they've looked at Exxon, they've looked at other types of organizations which are stigmatized. So some studies have looked at AIDS clinics, abortion clinics, how do these different organizations manage the day-to-day operations in an environment where they're stigmatized? But again, of course, organization studies suffer from key limitation is that migrants, ethnic minorities, they just don't exist in that literature. There's no discussion of those types of organizations. It's primarily focusing on firms. So for-profit, market-centered firms, less emphasis on immigrant organizations or ethnic associations. And then finally, an emerging field is transnational social protection, which it's very nice. IMI is actually one of the leading centers on the research on this, thanks to Marie Ronson and Dominic's work on transnational social protection. So just briefly, social protection refers to strategies to cope with risks that may arise in the economy, healthcare, education. And as Thomas Feist explains in a working paper a couple years ago, that global mobility and immigrants, that people that are mobile, are really reorganizing social protection because of their mobility across borders. And that social protection can occur at multiple scales. So it can occur at the household level, it can occur at the level of the state, it can occur at the level of the market, and then of course in civil society. And that's really the focus of what I'm talking about today. But again, the limitations of this growing emerging field still is that most of the stuff that's come out on social protection hasn't really examined how this operates, again, with this environment of global war on terror. So how do people that are engaging in that, whether it's households, whether it's organizations, how do they operate and function in this global regulatory environment? So again, what this project tries to do is bring together these three literatures and to generate a dialogue by kind of contributing and looking at, and trying to address these gaps in all three literatures. So these are the two key research questions that I want to talk about today. So the first one is, what does Pakistani transnational social protection look like at the organizational level across these three cities, London, Toronto, and New York? And then second, how does the global war on terror regulatory regime affect Pakistani migrant transnational organizations, again, in these three cities? So I want to briefly talk about the group selection and the site selection. So why Pakistani migrants? So there was a few different reasons driving why this group was chosen in particular. First was a demographic reason. Pakistani immigrants are the largest foreign Muslim population in Britain, in Canada, and the United States. So that was one of the interests for, again, to pick the group that is the targeting of many of these policies. Another issue was that, at least in North America, Pakistani migrants are a very understudied immigrant community. There's very little research on them. And it's interesting because it's very different compared to the UK, where they've been studied again in the UK. So it was interesting to pick a group that we don't know very much about in the US, what's going on with them. And then, of course, the war on terror. Right? So I mean, Pakistan as a country and Pakistani communities have had a very central role in the war on terror, some in positive ways, some in not so positive ways. And again, it's a little bit surprising that there's so little research on this community, given the fact that it has played such a prominent role in the war on terror and counterterrorism in the United States and Canada. Now, the site selection, the reason these three cities were picked was to create theoretical leverage of difference across the three cities. So the first key areas of difference between these three cities is the migration histories. So Pakistani migration to London has been going on since the 19th century. And it really began in a large-scale labor migration after World War II. It was primarily a labor migration coming from a handful of villages in Pakistan. And it, in many ways, it resembled what's called like a chain migration, or a migration system, if you will. And it's very different from the Pakistani migration that happened decades later to New York City and Toronto, which was primarily comprised of very high-skilled migrants that came to the United States and Canada after there was a liberalization of immigration laws. Now, related to this, these three communities have very different socioeconomic profiles. By far, the most affluent of these three communities, Pakistanis, are the ones in New York. So they have the highest levels of education, highest levels of income, highest levels of home ownership, and compared to these other two communities. Toronto is kind of in between, and then in London, really, it's the lowest of the three communities. So we see the lowest levels of socioeconomic attainment in London. And then, of course, the three cities vary in terms of incidence of large-scale terrorism. So, as we all know, New York is the epicenter of 9/11, as well as it's the epicenter of all of the counterterrorism policies that have been enacted in the United States. And London also had a large-scale attack, not quite at the scale of 9/11. And Toronto essentially served as a control city, but a city that hasn't had a large-scale terrorist attack. And again, recall, the point is to see to what extent is this regulatory regime operating in these three cities, and how is it affecting these organizations. So the analytic strategy had two stages. The first stage was to map the organizational infrastructure for Pakistani migrant communities in these three cities. The second stage was to then use in-depth interviews to comparatively analyze the experiences, the behaviors, and the strategies of these Pakistani organizations, and the ones in particular for this talk, the social service organizations. So the first step was to construct the database. So how I did this is I did a great deal of content analysis of local and national directories of organizations, associations, and charities. And these lists exist in all three of these countries and the cities, and a lot of them are based on tax classifications, because at least in the US and Canada, these organizations don't pay taxes. In the UK, they have a similar designation as a voluntary association. So these databases were used to then do coding and content analysis to figure out which organizations are Pakistani. And there was a whole method I used, along with some research assistants, to determine which organizations were primarily either being staffed by Pakistani immigrants or serving the Pakistani community. So of course, within this, there were pan-ethnic organizations that focused on South Asians, there were religious organizations in the US, there were some that are called Asian American associations, and this was all used to then construct this database. Now, the organizations were also coded according to the programmatic domain, so what type of services they offer, and as well as the geographic scope of action. So are they focusing on the local Pakistani community in these three cities, or are they transnationally oriented organizations focusing on Pakistan, or both? This gives you a kind of an idea of what the sector looks like across three cities. So just quickly, just so it makes sense. So the orange bars are London, The pink ones are Toronto, and the purple ones are New York, and you can see the different programmatic domains. And what I want to draw attention to with you is this. This was one of the really interesting findings, that in London, the vast majority of Pakistan organizations are social service organizations. And also relatedly, the interesting thing is that the vast majority of these organizations are transnational. So here you'll see the difference between organizations that are transnational versus locally focused, and you'll see that when you look at London, Toronto, and New York, the vast majority of organizations for Pakistani immigrants here in London are transnational. So they're focusing primarily on Pakistan. And it's important to note, they're not doing both. These organizations are purely transnational. They don't do anything in the UK. They don't have any significance. They don't have any programs for the UK. It's purely social service delivery in Pakistan. Now the second step of the dialogue strategy was to recruit people to interviews. Now, one of the key problems with a lot of this kind of research is you end up getting a lot of the same type of people, right? It is a convenience sample or a snowball sample. So in my case, I had a luxury in the sense that I had this database of all these organizations, and I treated it essentially as a census. So in 2013, when the database was created, I treated it as a full census of all the Pakistani organizations across the three cities. What that enabled me to do was to create a sampling frame and a way to generate a random sample of people to interview. So what I did is I stratified the organizations by their domain, what they did, and whether or not they were national or local, and proceeded then to create randomized lists and contacted every third organization on that list to try to generate. And the whole purpose of all this extra effort was really just to try to increase the heterogeneity of the interview respondents. I had a 73% response rate from doing that process, which resulted in 86 interviews with organization leaders. I supplemented those interviews then with also interviews with government officials, counterterrorism officials, and then key informants knowledgeable with the sector, which resulted in a total of 131 in-depth interviews across the three cities. Most interviews took 45 minutes to 3 hours. I analyzed the interview data with the Nevo qualitative software. Most of the interviews were conducted in English, however, some of them were conducted in English. And then finally, I did 200 hours of personalization at organization events, fundraising events, a variety of other types of events that I was invited to check out. So this is just a breakdown of what the interview data looks like. So you can see that's the breakdown of organizations, who I interviewed, government officials. So I'm going to now go to the findings. So the first finding has to do with this idea of where is the transnational social protection, what does that look like? So what the findings showed, and you saw on the graph, is that the highest concentration of transnational social service organizations is in London, much higher than Toronto or New York. So in and of itself, that's interesting, but it doesn't really tell you why. Like, why are there so many transnational organizations? So for that, the interview data is actually kind of illuminating, and it does help you help me understand what's going on. So I want to share with you some of the motivations that organization leaders shared with me of why they were focusing on transnational social service delivery. So this is from an organization here, leader here in London, Aisha, and she explains, "We feel the need to give back because we have been very fortunate to leave and have successful lives here. My children are healthy and attending good schools in Britain, but people back in my village do not have enough food to eat. My personal work began after the floods in 2005. Our village was devastated. People lost everything. For a while, there was a big push to donate to lots of public Americans, but it all faded away, and people are still struggling. So that was how we set up our mission and have continued to send donations to help with food and medicine." So in this quote, what you see is, again, this initial transnational kind of action began after disaster, which is common. We find that in a lot of different studies, that if a disaster happens, people get mobilized. But in this sense, this respondent really expressed a sense of guilt that, you know, we've come to Britain, we're doing well, we're taken care of, but people back home don't have anything. This is why, you know, in this particular case, why she's exerting all this energy to try to do this social service delivery. This is another quote from someone also in London who has the same kind of sentiment. I'm going to share it just again to just show this was a very common theme between the interview data. So Reza explains that we are the lucky ones. We were able to leave and come to Britain. I don't mean to say that everything is wonderful here. There are problems just like anywhere. But if I get sick or my daughter gets sick, I can see a doctor and get medicine I need within a matter of days. If you get sick in Pakistan and are not wealthy, there's nothing for you. This is why we focus our efforts on helping people in Pakistan. If we don't take action, then nobody will help. So again, This quote actually is something, it's similar to the last one. One of the things that came up in this, and this was a recurring theme talking to social service, transnational social service organizations, was this real sense of that you can't rely on the state to do anything in Pakistan. There is nothing for you, there is no social safety net, there is no protection, nothing will happen unless we, those that have left, are able to give back and transnationally provide that social protection. I want to now shift to other findings that have to do more with how the global war on terror affects these organizations. So the first findings are around this issue of stigma, which was a key theme that kept emerging in the interviews. And what happened was that over 60% of the world leaders that I interviewed said that they felt stigmatized because of the Pakistani or Muslim identity of the organization or the members that they serve. 85% of the transnational social service organizations reported feeling stigmatized because of their work in Pakistan. But what's interesting about the stigma is that it wasn't just one thing, it was actually quite fluid. And from the interviews, what emerged was there was three forms that this stigma was taking. The first was a local backlash type of stigma. This happened to organizations right after these large-scale terrorist attacks. The second form of stigma was tied to the global regulatory regime, which had to do with kind of guilt by association stigma, which was related primarily to investigation. So if an organization was investigated in New York City, all the Pakistan organizations felt that, okay, we're all have to worry about this. There's this guilt by association thing happening. And then the third, which is something for me and was very surprising, was a high level of collective mistrust and suspicion from within the Pakistani community towards these organizations. So again, I want to use the qualitative data to illustrate these different types of stigma. So the first one, the anti-Muslim backlash, this is from a director in London. He explains, right after the bombs, a few hours later, I got a call from some woman asking if I cared to make a statement about the Muslim community's reaction. Later that day, I started to watch news reports. I realized she was calling me because she identified us as representing the community the most likely committed this horrible act. Following day, we got calls from all kinds of news companies here in the UK and from other places. The main question they wanted to know is, why would a Paki born in Britain do this? So we became spokespersons for all Pakis and Muslims in Britain. So this was a very common thing that happened in New York, in Toronto, less so in Toronto, but in New York and London. After these large scale attacks, organizations all of a sudden felt they were spokespeople. Now for all the terrorists, anyone that was suspected of doing it, they had this new job. The media kept contacting them saying that, you know, what do you have to say? Do you care to make a statement while it's happening? So this was one of the stigmas that people talked about right after the attacks, which has been documented maybe back in the committee goes in here about a backlash that kind of follows that incident. The other one that I mentioned, stigma, was the collective mistrust. This is reflected here in these comments from Noreen, director of an organization in Toronto. She explains, the real challenge for us is building trust with other Pakistanis here in Canada. Most people don't trust NGOs working in Pakistan. People think that they do nothing except provide cushy jobs for children and retired generals in Islamabad and Lahore. Plus, you have the CIA using NGOs to infiltrate Pakistani society. I mean, look at the Osama thing. They made a fake NGO for polio vaccinations and created a whole CIA apparatus over there. These types of things really make Pakistani suspicious of organizations like ours. So this was one of the more surprising stigmas that emerged. People said that not only are we stigmatized by all the general public, but we're stigmatized by Pakistanis don't want to donate, don't want to interact with us because they think that, you know, that we're probably not actually doing what we're saying we're doing with the money. So this was another form of stigma that emerged. And then finally, as I mentioned, the other type of stigma that emerged had to do with the regulatory regime, high-profile investigations. This is a quote from Ahmad, who's talking about what happened to the organization after one of their partner organizations was investigated by the FBI. He explains, for the organization, things got really bad in late 2002 after the FBI began investigating two charities for links to terrorism. I don't want to go into details about them because some of them were my friends. But it seemed from the start the government was determined to blame someone, even if there was no evidence. Well, 1 week after this, we started getting phone calls from local newspapers asking us where we sent our money and whether we were prepared to cooperate with the police. It was like we were all guilty now just because we are a Muslim organization. At fundraisers, people began to tell me they were afraid to donate zakat to us because they thought the FBI might arrest them later. This fear created by the FBI makes fundraising very difficult for us. So this quote is meant to really illustrate another common thing that emerged in the interview data about how organizations struggle when other organizations were investigated in the same city. But how do these organizations respond? So that was the question I had. So okay, so this is happening, now what do you do? How do you respond to this kind of stigma? And this is where another interesting finding in the work came up. which was that there was really homogenization of these stigma management strategies. That's how he referred to the paper. And what people kept talking about over and over again was, oh, what we do is we're transparent, accountable, and professional. Transparency, accountability, professionalization. I mean, almost every time you talk to them, say, oh, so you've been stigmatized, what do you do about it? They say, oh, we spent all this money on being transparent, professional, and accountable. And going back again to organization studies and thinking about this from what literature's been written on organizations, it became clear that what I was seeing in this data was a case of coercive institutional isomorphism. So this external pressure created by the regulatory regime exerts a pressure on those organizations, and it's resulting in them all starting to act very much like one another across the three cities. So this homogenization of practices. I have a quote to share that gives you a little bit of an example of how people understood this transparency. This is from a director of organization in New York, and he explains how a certain level of transparency is to be expected. In our case, the situation is worse because we're Muslim and our charity was working in Pakistan. We had to submit all of our financial records to federal officials and always have a sense of worry. I mean, we're just as concerned as the government that our funding for project does not get into the hands of terrorist groups. So that is the difference. We have this extra level of stress because who we are and what we do. I've been working in the nonprofit sector for 20 years, and I can tell you the level of transparency we have is above and beyond most nonprofits. But more to the point, the level of stress we have is much higher, because if we were a homeless shelter or a humane society, we would not have to worry about being investigated by Homeland Security or our funds being used by terrorists. So again, this quote kind of illustrates something that, again, was very recurrent across the three cities, and people feeling pressured to be very transparent, very accountable, and to really allocate funds to make sure these things were happening. But there are consequences, right, of doing that. And I've alluded to it already about in terms of the funds it requires to be transparent. And the two key consequences of all this across the three cities were increasing administrative costs, as I mentioned, constrained organizational agency, that's directly related to it, right? So if your administrative costs are going up because you have to be so transparent, so accountable, there's less money to actually do the mission statements that you're supposed to do. And finally, I'll talk about this in a minute, interestingly, increasing informality. So I want to, like, again, give you some, use the data to kind of help you understand what this would look like. So this is an example of construction. This is the director of an organization that creates orphanages for girls in Pakistan. So she explains how on two occasions our wire transfers were intercepted and held for weeks. This meant that we could not send money to buy food for the girls for 2 weeks. I had to use my own personal savings. We talked to a lawyer and he told me we needed to become more professional and more transparent. Get audits from accounting firms, make a better website, but all those things cost a lot of money. Money that is supposed to go to the orphanage. I think at this rate, my dream of opening more orphanages will have to wait, because with all the cost of making the organization more professional, there just isn't enough money. So this quote from Zara, this director, what it really conveys is how, because of this pressure to be transparent, because of the pressure to more or less mimic the other organizations in this sector, that in many ways her agency, her individual agency and agency organization is really constrained by those pressures. In terms of informality, this is one of the most interesting findings that comes from this, is you see the same pressures and raising administrative costs leading some people to just get rid of their organizations and stop functioning as a formal organization and move into informality. This is expressed by Nusrat here, director of New York City organization, and this was a religious education organization that used to function in New York. He explains, we tried to keep the organization going for as long as we could, but after the investigation, we had a hard time getting donations. Even though nothing came of it, people around here were nervous to donate or officially enroll their children in our classes. We eventually closed down the organization and stopped operating as a 501c. Now we hold weekly classes in our house or in the homes of people who invite us. In some ways it is easier, but in some ways I miss having our own space and presence in the city and the community. So this is an example of someone who, these people were not formally investigated, but there was this kind of informal discussion in New York that, oh, are you radicalizing people through your Islamic education? So that created a lot of stigma for them, and the people that used to donate and send their kids stopped sending their kids there because they were afraid. And, you know, if there's any truth to this, we don't want to be associated, we don't want our kids going there. So what these folks did is they stopped operating as a 501c, they got rid of their office space, and now they do it in their basement of their home or other people's homes. So they're not operating as a formal organization anymore. And I'll talk about why that's so such a peculiar finding. So I do want to wrap up now and go over some of the key conclusions that came out of this work. So I think that one of the things that's interesting in terms of social protection is that access to formal social protection in London, in the UK, the access these immigrants have, that may explain why there's such a high concentration of Pakistani migrant transnational social service organizations in London. At least that's what that was the theme that emerged from the interview data, where people repeatedly kept talking about the NHS, talking about how they have all these access to all these things that don't exist in Pakistan, which is why they feel the need to give back to Pakistan. Now, we can people complain all the time about the NHS, me included, but I guess if you're from Pakistan and there's nothing like that, then when you're comparing it relatively, it seems like, okay, well, there is a social safety net here, and there's nothing else. So this is why we're going to work on social service delivery from Pakistan. So that's an interesting finding and conclusion. I think the other key conclusion from this is that stigma is fluid, and that multiple stigmas affect the behaviors and strategies of all types of Pakistani immigrant organizations in all three cities. So regardless of the contextual differences of the cities, regardless of the migration histories that are different, there's a similar stigma going on, and it's operating at different levels in the three cities. And then, as I mentioned before, another interesting finding or conclusion is that what we see is that the regulatory environment of the world war on terror, it really does function as this external pressure, which is resulting in a homogenization of these organizations. So they're becoming increasingly more and more similar because of the pressures that are being exerted on them in terms of how they go about their everyday practices. And then finally, as I mentioned a moment ago, there are unintended consequences of all of this. So mainly the constrained agency at the organizational level and this informality. Now, I want to finish with some other thoughts and some statements. I just want to be curious to see what people think about this in the Q&A. So I really believe in the paper, I argue this, and I think as more research is coming out on this topic, we're going to see more of this, that the war on terror that we have today, it really reflects a reorganization of state control. So even though we've seen a declining significance of the state, and we have many empirical examples of that, where we do see that through transnational social spaces, through a variety of different means, migrants in particular, mobile people, are able to transverse and kind of, in some ways, go beyond the confines of national borders. At the same time, we see that terrorism as a symbolism, enables states to reorganize and exert new forms of control. It's interesting that today, we have the war on terror still going on, very strong in the United States, and it's against certain groups. There's a new player now, IS, we have Al-Qaeda, our good old-time favorite enemy of the United States, we've got the Taliban. But at the same time, you've got President Assad, Putin, all these guys today saying they're all fighting terrorists. So everybody's fighting a war on terror. And it's interesting because a lot of this is also an example of state control. So I think that this is a more theoretical thing to think about. Is there a reorganization happening of state control through this idea of the war on terror? And what does that mean for migrants and migration? I think that the global state control I'm talking about really does constrain transnational social protection for migrant groups targeted by counterterrorism policies. I think that that's something that will need to be addressed more in this growing field of transnational social protection, that yes, it's happening, but is it happening the same for all groups? Which instances is it going to work? Which instances is it not going to work? And I think that this is an element that's going to be important if you're looking at migrants from North Africa, the Middle East, or certain Asian countries. And then finally, reflecting back on Dimash and Pop. So the article I talked about this from organization studies, it's called The Iron Cage Revisited. Right? It's about irrationality of rational actions. The unintended consequences I mentioned from all of this, so the constrained agency on the part of these organizations and the increasing informality, it really reflects this irrationality of the global regulatory regime. If the stated policies of counterterrorism is to stop terrorists, stop the spread of extremism, stop all these things, it doesn't make much sense to police the organizations that are trying to alleviate poverty, trying to alleviate a variety of other factors in places like Pakistan, which are known to contribute to extremism. And it doesn't make much sense to push organizations into informality where they move further away from the regulatory eye of the state. So those are the thoughts I'll finish with. I can see you leave with that. We've talked about it. So I should stop. I always try to do this. Thank the supervisors and mentors that helped me bring this project along, as well as all of the people that gave me money to do the research and the logistical support. And what's an interesting thing is 2 years ago, I was here as a fellow, thanks to Oliver and Hein, who gave me logistical support to do the fieldwork and mentor from here. And it's kind of nice to be back 2 years later, giving the final results of all of that work that happened 2 years ago. So thanks, I look forward to questions and comments and criticisms.
Thank you.